ahead and get started. Good morning, everyone. It's good to see you all this morning. We're continuing this summer in our reading of the book of Genesis. There is there's a line from Isaac Asimov that I come back to now and then, something he said toward the end of his life when the world was already kind of spinning a bit too fast for its own good. He wrote, "The saddest aspect of life right now is that science gathers knowledge faster than society gathers wisdom." Anybody feel that? We know more than ever about our own world. We've mapped the human genome. We split the atom. We've sent humans to the moon and back, if you believe that sort of thing. We created the internet and smartphones and artificial intelligence. But we seem to know less and less about what any of it means. You know what I mean? What it's for, what it's worth, and how to use it all wisely. And we chase answers kind of as a cure to our restlessness and lack of meaning and understanding. When things go wrong, we look for information, more information, which works great if our problem is a lack of information, but if our problem is a lack of wisdom, we're in real trouble. We have very little access to wisdom in our society. They say that for most of human history, the kind of sum total of human knowledge used to double every 100 years or so, about the rate of a wise old tree growing in the backyard. That's how it was for centuries, until about the year 1900. That's when everything started to really speed up. By the end of World War II, they say knowledge was doubling every 25 years. By the time I was in high school in the 80s, best decade to be in the high school, by the way, it was doubling once every decade. By 2017, it was doubling once a year. Today, they say it might be doubling as fast as once every day. And how fast has wisdom doubled over that time? That elusive thing, the heart's understanding, how to walk in the world, how to order our common life together in a way that leads to the flourishing of all. Has wisdom doubled once in that whole time? It's funny that 1900 is the tipping point. That's also the year that Friedrich Nietzsche died, the German philosopher. It's a kind of a strange coincidence given that Nietzsche spent his whole life trying to warn humanity that without a moral imagination, without wisdom, we would be left in a world where might makes right, or what he called the will to power. We would be ruled by the will to power. And he warned that this would end badly for humanity. He said the 20th century would be the most destructive and horrifying the world had ever seen, and he was right. Nearly 100 million people died in wars. Hitler, Stalin, and Mao, all of whom were influenced by Nietzsche, killed more than 100 million of their own people for political reasons. Think about that. In the century following that 1900 kind of turning point, as the acquisition of knowledge began accelerating, more than 200 million people died violent deaths in wars and for politics. Martin Luther King Jr. said, "We have guided missiles and misguided men. We can split the atom, but we can't resolve our conflicts without violence. We can map the genome, but we can't get everybody affordable health care. We can simulate human thinking, but can't just honor basic human decency. We have an incredible amount of knowledge at our fingertips, and yet we have a lack of wisdom that's stunning. And there's a big difference between knowledge and wisdom, you know, that seems lost on a lot of people. Knowledge is about facts and information. It's about having kind of theoretical or practical understanding of something. Wisdom is about discerning how to walk in the world, how to apply all of our knowledge in life-giving ways. Immanuel Kant said, "Science is organized knowledge. Wisdom is organized life." These past 2 weeks, we've been talking about Genesis 1 through 3 and the way the Jewish faith and then the Christian faith subsequently talked about our natural human capacities and our vocation to conserve and nurture the world, to order the world in cooperation with God and lead the world toward shalom. And it's one of the central claims of our tradition that human beings have been endowed with the capacity for wisdom. We have the natural ability to make sound judgments and decisions based on knowledge and experience, but also kind of in our understanding of natural consequences, and especially through the conscious pursuit of wisdom, of what is good and meaningful and important in our lives. Part of the image of God within humanity is this capacity for wisdom. But as humans in the pursuit of wisdom, we are prone to take shortcuts. You know what I mean? We prefer things that are fast, easy, and painless. But there's no fast, easy, painless way to wisdom. Fools rush in. Wisdom takes time. Comes slowly, through struggle, often through failure, and encounter with limits. And in our preference for shortcuts, we often substitute knowledge for wisdom, data for discernment, information for insight. And because of technology, these shortcuts are now more enticing than ever. But wisdom, man, it comes slowly through struggle. Knowledge is growing so fast and is so readily available in our time. It's little wonder that wisdom, kind of that slow, kind of messy process, it's not as important as knowledge. And so we have unprecedented access to knowledge and almost no access to wisdom. Maybe even a diminishment in the human capacity for wisdom. This week, Christina Bond pointed me to this new MIT study about how AI is affecting human intelligence. Does anybody else read about this? It was in the news a lot. Researchers work with 60 different college students from five universities in Boston, and they would bring them in and ask them to write an essay over three different sessions. They came in three different times, and the questions were reflective. So it's like, should we always think before we speak? Write for this on 20 minutes. They put them in three groups. One group could use ChatGPT, another group could use Google, and the third group was called the brain-only group. They could only have this work with no technology at all. And as they were writing, they were hooked up to an EEG machine, so they could measure their brain activity. And the results from this are pretty astounding. The brain-only group showed significantly higher and more widely distributed brain activity, and their neural patterns were associated with deeper human brain function like creativity, memory, ideation, semantic processing. The ChatGPT group showed low attentional engagement and minimal executive functioning. They weren't really paying attention or making meaningful decisions. They ran the essays through algorithms to analyze the language and had experts grade them, evaluate the writing. They found the essays from the ChatGPT and Google group were kind of formulaic and shallow. They often use the very same structure, the same examples, even the same language sometimes. Experts grading them called the writing soulless. Meanwhile, the brain-only bunch, they showed just great depth and real originality. There's diversity in their thinking about the subject. And their vocabulary was more sophisticated. They were more personally engaged. They asked better questions. They also found that across the three different sections, this is so funny to me, the ChatGPT users got more and more lazy. Like at first they tried to hide how much they were copying, by the end they were just all cutting and pasting the whole essay into it. Only took three sessions to get there. And at the end of it, they couldn't remember what they had written. They brought them in for a fourth session and then asked them to rewrite one of the essays they had done before. The AI folks had not integrated their work into their memory. They couldn't remember. The brain-only group had. They could quote extensively from their own essay. They could reproduce their work. They felt ownership of it. But I think one of the most concerning findings was that when the AI users, the ones who had done the three with AI and then came in for the fourth one and did brain only, what they found was their brain activity did increase, but it never reached the same levels as the group who had never used AI. It never got to that real kind of deep, sophisticated brain function of creativity, ideation, memory. Even offline, their minds didn't re-engage at the same level. Something had shifted just by the use of AI. Altered how their minds were working, even after they unplugged. And researchers, they're careful to say, you can't draw too many conclusions from this, but they clearly showed how that fast, easy shortcut of AI appeared to inhibit and diminish the brain's natural capacity for meaning-making and discernment, and even, you might say, wisdom. Genesis chapter 3 explores the human capacity for wisdom in the ordering of the world. And it also explores the consequences when we take shortcuts. Now, Genesis 1 through 3 also might be, the most misunderstood and misused three chapters in the entire Bible. Anybody feel that one too? Especially the story of Adam and Eve and the serpent. One of the most common mistakes people make, in fact, is to say this is a story about the origins of sin and death and evil. It's often referred to as the fall of humankind. That's language that's actually not in the Bible itself. The Old Testament never refers to this event as a fall. It never talks about human creatures as fallen. And it doesn't speak about Adam and Eve's sin as bringing sin into the world or upon all of humanity. The Old Testament always assumes that humanity can obey the purposes of God, can become wise, even after expelled from the garden. So Genesis 3 is not a story about the origins of sin and death and evil. It's a story about the acquisition of wisdom. Humans are placed in the garden with these two special trees. There's a tree of life and a tree of the knowledge of good and bad. So symbolically, they have access to immortality and to all knowledge. But what they don't have access to at that point is wisdom. And in the access of wisdom, one of the first things we should notice is that God does not just give them a bunch of rules, which is usually where religious people want to go. There's no comprehensive set of rules about good and bad here. And there's a lot of reasons for this. It's really easy to follow rules and do that from a bad motivation, so it never really touches the heart. Sometimes you got to break the rules in order to do the right thing in a really messed up situation. And so God's goal isn't to create a bunch of rule followers. That's not the same as wisdom. God wants people of character, people with moral capacity, wise people who can mature and grow and into divine-like wisdom to lead the world toward shalom. And no knowledge or no set of laws will be able to substitute for wisdom. However, the acquisition of wisdom, it's almost always going to involve an encounter with some kind of limit. Like, humans have incredible freedom in the story, but it's not unlimited freedom, because not everything leads to shalom, right? One of the main problems with kind of Western culture and our understanding of freedom sort of in the post-Enlightenment world is that when we think of freedom, most of us think of a lack of constraint. Freedom is just getting to do anything we want to do as long as it doesn't interfere with other people's ability to do whatever they want to do. We call that freedom, which is actually misleading. True freedom is not the absence of constraint. The absence of constraint is chaos. Freedom is finding limits that give us the ability to express our true humanity, to actually become human as human was intended to be. It always involves some kind of discipline or limits. And learning how to do this well, it can only come through wisdom. So how does one become wise? Well, we need a teacher, someone who knows, who can teach us, help us navigate the complexities of life. We also need patience and time, because there's no shortcuts to wisdom. You learn how to live mostly by living. And in the book of Genesis, it says those things will only come by living in cooperation, in relationship with God. And so God only gives them one rule. You are free to eat from any tree in the garden, but you must not eat from the tree of the knowledge of tov and ra. Those are the Hebrew words, good, and it's often translated good and evil. But ra is not really evil. You know, evil is, in English, is a moral, always a moral category. But ra is, it just means bad. Like in the scripture, it'll talk about sour grapes having gone raw. They went bad. Or sometimes God causes something raw to happen, something bad. It's just, raw just means it's not always a moral category. So it's really the tree of the knowledge of good and bad. And the phrase is what's called a merism. It's a figure of speech where you explain a concept by saying like the two extremes, and it applies everything in between. So it's like life from A to Z. Or top to bottom, or beginning to end. That's tov and ra. So eating the fruit of this tree doesn't make them magically aware of evil, and isn't about the origins of evil. These actions here are presented as this temptation to take a shortcut on the path to wisdom. It's really, they're going to try to just grasp in an instant knowledge about everything from A to Z without having to work for it or struggle, which ends up being really essentially knowledge without wisdom, which we know is really dangerous. So God says, don't eat of this tree because there's no shortcut to wisdom. You got to learn some limits, how to not be ruled by your desires. And this process happens slowly and patiently over time. I'll walk you through it. I'll be with you the whole way. We'll get to all of it in time. And so hopefully we can see that this one rule, it's not just set up as some arbitrary moral test. Can they obey God? And if they don't, they're going to die. God's not withholding. God is going to teach them wisdom, right? And how it's properly acquired. I mean, God clearly wants them to have the knowledge of good and evil. He's just told them, you're going to rule the whole world. You're going to need to know tov and ra. And they're gonna make a mess of it if they don't have that. And there are no shortcuts. So eating from the tree just represents a shortcut, bypassing the slow, patient work of acquiring wisdom, how to live in the world as God's agents. So they'll get knowledge from this tree, but they're not gonna get wisdom. And this is dangerous. And in the story, of course, as we read, they make the wrong choice. We're told the serpent was more arum, crafty, than any of the wild animals the Lord God had made. Arum is, it's crafty or shrewd. It's actually, you can use it to say wisdom, but it's wisdom like street smarts, you know? So it can get used for good or evil. So it's the serpent's not crafty, like it's not being called a denigrating name here. In fact, in Proverbs 22, this is just one of dozens of examples where it says the arum, the crafty, the shrewd, sees raw, sees bad, and avoids it and hides. So the serpent's not being called evil. It's just that these street smarts the serpent has can be used for tov or raw, for good or bad. And we have this dialogue. The serpent says, did God really say to you that you can't eat from any tree in the garden, which isn't what God said? So he's messing with Eve. Some of the rabbis I read said that he was he starts out this way so that Eve will correct him. It's just kind of a sales tactic. And then she says, well, we may eat from the trees of the garden, but God did say you must not eat from the fruit from the tree that is in the middle of the garden. You must not touch it or you will die. And God didn't say don't touch it. She's making it sound like God is unreasonably strict here. The serpent comes back. You will not certainly die, the serpent said to the woman. For God knows that when you eat from it, your eyes will be open and you will be like God, knowing tov and ra, good and bad. It's really interesting here to remember, hasn't God already told them they'll be like God? They're created in the image of God. To be like God, to be God's representatives. And then they're in the process of acquiring wisdom from God. God comes and walks with them in the cool of day and talks about their lives and teaches them the path to wisdom. But the serpent is saying, God's not telling you the truth. God's kind of being withholding. And you're blind. You need to have your eyes open here. You can be like God, knowing Tova and Ra. But in fact, God has already told them they can be like God. You can have, he's given them all this freedom. He says, you can have everything except for this one thing that will ruin it. And you're just going to have to trust me on this. But the serpent has them kind of forgetting all about the freedom and the blessing, and all they can see is the one thing they can't have, the one limitation, which is just, you know, common. And so here's what happens. There's a little section that's organized as a chiasm. You know, when they organize it like a pyramid, and the center section is the most important part. So it starts out, the woman saw the tree was good for eating, that was desirable to the eyes to make one wise. And then comes the center. It says, she ate and he ate. And then it works its way back out in a parallel fashion. The eyes of both were open, and they saw they were naked, and they sewed leaves of a fig tree together and made themselves loin coverings. So the center is she ate, he ate. That's the most important part. The next layer out, as it ripples out either way, is the eyes. It's desirable to the eyes, and their eyes were opened. And then on the edges, we have these trees, one that's good for eating and the other that they use to cover themselves. So in the first sense, we've already seen that this encounter is a temptation of a shortcut to wisdom. Here, the temptation is the temptation to listen to some other source besides God, the serpent, right? And in doing so, just to distort and ignore everything God's promised so far. To listen to a different instructor. That's what they do. One that's crafty and shrewd, but not good. And he makes them think God's holding out on them. What he ends up basically saying, if you think about it, is that the wisdom you need is already within you. You don't need to wait on God or consult God. Just grab it. Just follow your heart. Follow your eyes, your desires. Take control of your own life and your own destiny. It's basically, this is the first self-help seminar ever. Don't be patient and do the hard, long work of waiting on God and acquiring wisdom. Just use this trick, this life hack, this self-help technique. And they essentially basically set themselves up in place of God as their own wisdom instructors. It's really ironic, too, given the fact that the tree of the knowledge of good and bad could have taught them wisdom by listening to God and not eating from it. They would have become wise. They would have become like God, who is wise. But what happens instead is, in the story, they become like trees. They cover themselves. They dress themselves up like trees. This is how we're supposed to read it. Either way, they're going to learn the knowledge of Tov and Ra, good and bad. It's just that one way will lead to them bearing the image of God. The other one has them bearing the image of this other source, the tree. And because they made this choice to listen to some other teacher who messes with their minds the way they see the world, they're going to completely ignore God. They're going to set themselves up as the arbiters of wisdom and grasp for the knowledge of Tov and Ra on their own terms and not end up at wisdom. And this is essentially how all idolatry works. We become like whatever we worship. If they trust God, they'll end up being like God. If they walk with God and the cool of the day and talk with God, then they'll learn Tov and Ra as wisdom, not by eating from the tree, but actually by not eating from the tree and trusting in God. And instead, they trust the serpent. They grab the fruit of the tree, and by the end of the story, we're supposed to see them dressing themselves up like trees. They get the knowledge, but not the wisdom. And so they're just completely confused about what they are. They're dressing up like nature. All right, step back a second. So in the book of Genesis, God is seen as the source of all wisdom, the creator, who sets the terms, for creation. And wisdom is not just knowledge, it's knowing how to order. It's the right ordering of the world. And it touches everything. Wisdom touches everything. Our language, our thought, our families, our government, the ordering of our relationships to God itself and other and world, our decision-making, and the acquisition of wisdom is slow, patient work. There's no shortcuts. The source of wisdom is found in God, not within oneself, not within humankind, not with a guru or a trick or self-help program. And yet to this very day, many other sources still really compete for influence over the people of God, like a serpent. Adam and Eve here, they're trying a shortcut, something fast and easy and painless, a way to wisdom without having to struggle for it. And they end up getting the knowledge, but not the wisdom. And that always makes a mess. And when they listen to the serpent instead of listening to God, they try some trick. They try a self-help strategy. And again, they get the knowledge, but not the wisdom. And so instead of becoming like God in wisdom, they become like the tree, dressed up like trees. They're imitating creation. We're meant to see it as idolatry. What's interesting to me is how God responds. He comes looking for them with questions. This is so important. God's initial reaction is to draw them close and then to keep teaching, asking questions. You know, the Jewish way to teach and learn is always questions, still to this day. So God's still teaching them, still prompting them to find wisdom and insight through these questions. He has three of them. Where are you? Who told you? And what have you done? All three of which turn out to be great teachers of wisdom in all times and places, right? Where are you? Like, do we know where we are? The terrain, can we locate ourselves in the world? Are we seeing clearly where we are and where we're going, or are we lost and disoriented? Who told you? This is who have you been listening to? What's the source? Whose counsel are we keeping? Are they wise? Are they trustworthy? And then what have you done? What have our actions been? Can you tell the truth about what you've been doing? And what are the consequences rippling out into the world? These are great questions for all of us in the pursuit of wisdom. God's immediate reaction here isn't to smite them or judge them or punish them. It's to keep teaching them with these questions. Now, there are consequences, for sure. They have to leave the garden. Instead of relationships of equality, remember with Eve being the Azer, the man will now rule over the woman. This is not how it's meant to be. The ground will resist their effort to grow things. There'll be barrenness and chaos. But really the grace of the story is they continue to live, and God continues to walk with them. And so I think, especially when we're looking at the kind of the judgments, the way to understand them, especially symbolically in the story, is that what it's telling us is about the loss of the garden as, in a sense, the forfeiture of this sacred space. A space where meeting with God is just natural, easy. And so learning wisdom for the ordering of the world, it's not really lost, it's just diminished. Our ability to do this kind of naturally becomes diminished. The loss of the garden is a loss of a space for an easy, sort of uncomplicated relationship to God, the source of all wisdom. And this increases the likelihood that we'll make a mess of creation. Instead of ordering it wisely, we'll create barrenness and chaos everywhere. We'll become reckless and often make things worse, which is sort of what we've done, because science gathers knowledge a lot faster than society gathers wisdom. So one of like the biggest takeaways from this story, so probably different than what we got taught in Sunday school, is that really, especially for followers of Christ, Christians, that the task of humanity in the post-Genesis 3 world, wake of this failure, is to spend our lives cultivating that sacred space again. Our own kind of Eden land in our life personally and in our life together as a faithful people of God, to institute habits and rhythms and practices of connection with the divine so God can give us wisdom about how to order our lives and to stick with this down through the years, cultivating this sensitivity to the presence of God and chasing wisdom as just one of the primary pursuits of our lives. This is part of what it means to be a Christian. It also means trying to avoid the mistakes Adam and Eve made. What ends up happening is we have to make the pursuit of wisdom central to our lives. Wisdom, that doesn't mean not knowledge. Knowledge is hugely important, but wisdom is kind of the queen of this. The pursuit of wisdom as the primary pursuit of our lives. Like, I don't know if this describes who we are, the church. But we're supposed to not be about, you know, success, chasing bigger, better, higher, stronger, faster. We're supposed to be about faithfulness. Not chasing just information, but wisdom for how to order the world. Ways to embody shalom and to extend it to the neighborhood. It means we have to do things like slow down. Don't take shortcuts on the path to wisdom. Don't chase fast, easy, painless, but patiently make the acquisition of wisdom our pursuit. If you think about it, a lot of the Christian practices are just ways of slowing us down. Sabbath, slow us down. Tithing, slow down. Don't spin it all. Solidarity with the excluded just slows us down so they can keep up. Can only go as fast as everyone can stick together. If anybody falls behind, we wait for them or we share with them what they need to keep up. Community as a practice slows us down. We move slower as a group. And it means making God the primary source of wisdom in our lives, like intentionally. I will listen to God. I will have some kind of relationship with God through which I can check all the other sources of wisdom that I encounter. So these are Christian practices like weekly worship, what we're doing right now, like our daily prayer, things like solitude, where we just hold our lives in the presence of God. We have to cultivate a sacred space, cultivate an Eden space in our daily and weekly, monthly, yearly habits and rhythms of life. And the last thing is kind of comes from God's response to this, which is we have to live the questions. I mean, God's response was to give them questions and prompt them to reflect on their actions. One of my all-time favorite quotes, something that I think about all the time, is from the poet Rilke. He says, be patient toward all that is unsolved in your heart and try to love the questions themselves, like locked rooms and like books that are now written in a very foreign tongue. Do not now, he says, seek the answers which cannot be given you because you would not be able to live them. Live the questions now. And perhaps you will then gradually, without noticing it, live along some distant day into the answer. I think Adam and Eve's failure was they tried to live the answers before they were ready. And they didn't live the questions. And living the questions is the path to wisdom. And the questions almost always open the door. You know this, right? It's almost always a question that opens the door to wisdom. And the pursuit of wisdom is meant to be our primary pursuit. This means questions are extremely powerful. I think the difference between living the questions and trying to live the answers is, I often use the example of, it's the difference between well digging and ditch digging. You know what I mean? Ditch digging is mostly on the surface. It moves stuff around on the surface of life where it's easy and obvious. But well digging is tapping deep down into the source of life. And my prayer is that we'll be at Redemption Church well diggers, not ditch diggers. That we'll learn to live the questions. And perhaps then, one day, find ourselves almost by accident living into the answers, into some sense of wisdom for the ordering of the world. Let's pray. Oh God, we thank you for this story, really for the book of Genesis and all the wisdom it conveys. And I pray that you would make this church a little Eden place in the world. A place where access to you becomes just a little more easy. And where you meet with your people in the cool of the day and you talk to us about our lives and the world. And that you lead us to wisdom. That we would then embody peace and extend that peace out into our lives, our friends and neighbors, our family, our workplaces. So everyone can flourish and live. This is our prayer. Amen.